And we are live today with special guest Terry Dunnage. How you doing, man?
Good, man. Nice man, to meet you.
Man, it's been ages. We spoke about this a long time ago with being able to get you on, and things have just come into play where it's just took a while to make this happen.
Yeah.
But you turn up today and you tell me this is the final one that you're doing.
Yeah, 100% the final one now.
Yeah. You say that it just feels repetitive sometimes, you going over the same story and everyone's heard it. But for me, I think like it's truly powerful what you speak about, the journey that you've been on and how you've come out of it the other end. I know it must be hard, like myself, when I talk about my brother and stuff, every time it does fall back to me a lot with my progression of being better. Yeah. But I know I've got to keep doing it. I'm not at the stage you're at yet where I can just walk away from that yet and just be like, my message is out there and it is what it is. But for me here today and you doing this with me, it's absolutely massive for the channel, and it's going to help a lot of people understand your journey and where you've gone with it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And on that sense, you've between me and yourself is that you've got so much that you can give. Mine was a story to inspire, and I think I've done as far as I can go now, as in that eventually I'd want to be anchored back to my what I survived. Now I want to put that behind me and just live again.
Yeah,
I get that. Like my thing now, but I do love inspiring people as well.
And that you do from day one of seeing your story, the first video I ever saw, and then seeing the ones along. Every time I've seen one with a new person, I've took a bit from that, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just made me it concreted that I wanted you as part of my channel, you know, and part of the message that we put out there.
And
you was one of the guys that I definitely wanted from day one on my channel.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
No, I appreciate you, man. So, you know, we're talking about it like everyone knows.
Everyone
for the
knows,
people
yeah,
that don't exactly. know, tell us a little bit about you and you know, your life and how things have turned out the way they have for you.
What, a life before the event? Or after?
Yeah, give us a little build-up of you, man.
So, me as a person, grew up in a council estate, so a working-class man, child or whatever. So there's not a lot I haven't done in life. I was a rogue myself when I was younger. Probably dabbled in everything, things that I shouldn't have done. But I was a product of my own environment, I guess. So I used to get up to no good. I was more of a lovable rogue, really. I just used to get up to no good all the time and sort of found a little bit of crime and stuff, I think, delved in and out of that. But I've always sort of been a working man. So I've always sort of like seen big visions to get out of the council estates, I guess. So I had the big dreams. So from a child, just an average council estate kid, really. But I learned a lot. What I realise now, before I say the story, is that from everything I went through when I was young, it gave me my head now, as in I built so much resilience from a kid, like living at all different people's houses, broken family, having a stepdad on the scene and whatnot. And he was abusive. Like there was so much that we went through as a child, but I was always sort of like on my own, spent a lot of time on my own. So in the end, I made loneliness my friend, which at the time, it affected my life a lot growing up. But looking back at it now, it built so much resilience. So it made me become resilient to what happened to me moving forward. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. So did you lock yourself off or find yourself that even though you're from your cancer state background, like myself,
yeah.
That I also had them dreams to get out, not for the fact that I didn't want to be known that I was from a cancer state, just because I had bigger dreams than what the people that I was surrounded with on the estate had for themselves.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you tie yourself into somebody else's dream, you end up falling back from where you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do believe everything happens for a reason. And I think the things that have happened to us in our life has enabled us to put us in a position where we're able to do what I think we're supposed to do.
Yeah.
It's just unfortunate for us that we had to go through what we had to go through to be able to understand that ourselves and get that message out there.
Exactly. And I'm proud of where I come. I would never change it for a world. I would never change any of my struggles that I had as a child or anything I ever did. I'll own it. Although it's not spoke about, but that's why I enjoy speaking about it, because I don't want to be people to look at me and think, oh, he's, you know, for what he went through. Yeah, I did go through some stuff, but at the same time, I have no regrets of anything I ever did when I was young, because I never physically hurt anybody, but I was up to no good. But that gave me everything to make me who I am today. So I can't forget, and I won't forget, and I'm super proud of coming from where I come from.
Yeah.
Regardless of the whatever I've got up to.
Yeah, I think it's very important, like, from day dot, is you never, ever forget, because there's so many people that do hit the path running and they do become a success that they fail to recognize themselves in the mirror through their progression. And with that, if you're forgetting who you are, if you're looking at yourself in the mirror, you can only imagine what everyone else is thinking of you along your journey. You're bound to gain a lot of haters and a lot of negativity within your life, and that's no good for anyone, you know?
No, 100%. I was like what you said there. I never wanted to get out of my environment. I just didn't want to do the norm, because where we're all going out on a Friday night as young, getting out of our nut, drinking, doing drugs, whatever we were doing, everybody, it was like Groundhog Day on my estate or the local pub. We'd all be in our local pub. It was like a scene out of Shameless. Do you know what I mean? That's the best way to
my
explain
ideal
it.
Place, mate. I live it there.
I loved it as well. But myself, I could go back to that now. I can have everything or nothing and go back to that. Yeah. But I just didn't fit in with doing the same shit day in, day out. I wanted to do something different. Mm-hmm. So from there, I literally started. My old man was a courier. And I had this idea once. We had no money. We were just, like I said, doing whatever little deals we could to keep going. And a funny story, this one. So this is a success story, but how we started it is the truth. So we hired this van, a Luton van. We went to this guy, a manager of this company, a pallet company, and said, look, we'll do the jobs that you can't do in all the hotels uptown where we can go on the underground car parks, deliver the pallets. And he said, all right, what were you charging? We said, whatever it was, a couple of grand a week, 3 grand a week, 2 men in a van. He said, brilliant, I'll give you a contract. But we didn't have no money. We're still getting that mindset of going out every Friday night, getting out of our nut, trying to drive the next day. We couldn't, about a month later, we couldn't even afford it, because we didn't even know you have to wait 2 months or whatever it was for, you know, for your invoice days.
Yeah.
So we couldn't afford a van no more. So with our council estate heads, just stupidness, but we changed the plates. We cloned our mate's van. So that we could keep doing the bloody contract here. And in the end, from that, it started like that, just from being rogue, again, doing dodgy things, not harming anyone, but I know it ain't, you know, I'm not praising it, but we done it. And in the end, I ended up owning the London, not owning, but subcontracting the London depot and the Rye Sussex depot. Wow. So in the end, I was turning over £3 million a year. So I was a council, I had all my workers working for me. Like all my friends working for me, not workers, but half of them were on tags. Do you know what I mean? So they had to be in, they couldn't deliver MI5, the scrubs. We had to deliver to everywhere that they couldn't, you know what I mean? Because all of a sudden I'm the depot now. And it was good times. And from going from nothing to that, I tasted like something that I've never tasted in my life, because I literally was buying Ferraris cash. I had a house, 2 Ferraris. But the biggest lesson I learned there is I had every watch and everything you could ever have. And then the jealousy, like you said, that stepped in. And I had people at my house with guns trying to take what I had. Yeah, it was some really shit times. And I learned that money was the root of all evil from the time of coming from nothing to everything. So from that, I never wanted to really come back to just being in that. I'd pop back and be myself, but I'd never really wanted anyone to know about my successes after that.
Yeah.
Because it ruined it for me. It wasn't shared amongst my people.
Mm.
So...
Yeah, I mean, you always see that, like, these footballers that are showing off their £100,000 watches that are getting, you know, people turning up to their house and robbing them when they're either there or they're away and their missus is there or anything like that, just to take a watch. So when you're sitting there from a council estate and everyone knows who you are, you still surround yourself and you're balling with all these different watches and Ferraris and that, like, you're bound to turn some noses up.
Well, you are what you surround yourself with. That's the lesson there, isn't it? So
there was that guy said, show me who your friends are and I'll tell you your future.
Yeah.
When I heard that, I was like, wow.
That's so true, though.
You know, because you're surrounding yourself with people that want it but are not hungry enough to get it. So when you get it, that's only going to form jealousy. So then, of course, with jealousy, you get the problems. And people always want what somebody else has got, and they're not willing to work for it. They're willing to take it, They'll come in and rob you. They'll probably even take your life because of it. Yep. You know, understanding the decimation that they're causing to themselves and family around them, like the ripple effect that about all the time. Yeah. It's so extensive that you don't realize you're doing it because you feel good. You've earned a little bit more. So you want to go and buy a Ferrari because that's your goal. That's your dream. That's yours. You know, so why people can't look at it and be happy for that is beyond me. But you don't realize that when you're buying that, you've put your life in danger.
Yep, 100%. I remember going to buy that cash. I bought it cash in Castle Rosso in Park Royal. My first ever one. I bought a 355 Spider. I went up there with a bag full of cash from my business account. I just drawed money out. I was paying wages in cash. They were the days when everyone was getting cash in hand.
Yeah.
I went up there to buy it. The guy wouldn't even take me seriously. And I remember the buzz. But you know, like, I was so buzzing when I got in here. I was dry. I think, fucking, I've made it. Like, but you know what? It was never shared with anyone because the only moment I had on my own, when I come back, it was never shared amongst everyone. Like, everyone else sort of had imposter syndrome around me. Everyone was like, yeah, it's all right, tell, but fucking hell, mate. Do you know what I mean? So,
and
bearing in mind, when I was a kid and I was in care and everything, not as in care in the system, but living at other people's houses that would take me on with my little gyro book or whatever and your milk tokens or whatever that was years ago. I dreamed of when you have the poster of the things on the wall, and then when it comes to fruition, when you actually do it, the only person that was ever proud of me who lived in the Isle of Man was my granddad. He said, fair play, boy, you've done well. Like, my dream was always to have a Rolex. So I bought 10 of them, sent him one. But it was never like, everyone just wants what you got then.
Mm.
So I just, it was a big lesson, that. Big lesson.
Did you ever find that, like, throughout your success and you had the dreams, that once you had it, it weren't really the hype that you thought it was?
100%, yeah.
Because I sat there and I think to myself, oh, my dream car is this, and I'll get it, and then I'll be like...
You're bored of it, aren't you, after a few days?
Yeah, like, really.
The buzz is trying to get it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, as soon as you got it, the buzz... I could strive for anything, achieve it. The buzz was always achieving it. Once I got it, it's just like... The Ferraris, I didn't even drive. I left one of my sisters drive in the end. And her house nearly got burgled 10 times for it, so that I just got rid of that because it was causing her stress, just parking on her job. I didn't literally use it. Once I had it, after a few months, it was just like nothing to me. Didn't even care about it. And that's anything I've ever done in my life. I just love the challenge of, because when someone tells you you can't have that.
Had that all my whole life, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a funny feeling, that, though.
Yeah, it really is.
But it's a good drive, but it's just channeling that drive.
100%. 100%. And do you know what it is? As the older you get and you've proved everyone wrong, less people say you ain't never going to be able to do that because they know that if they say it, you're going to prove them wrong.
Exactly, yeah.
So, like, I think, like, as you get older and you get people that are saying things like that, that you kind of wish that people still said it so you can still have that hunger to prove them wrong.
Yeah. I miss that now, because there's nothing to strive for no more.
Yeah, I know, man. I often sit there and I think to myself, I wonder if the people that said I was not going to do nothing with my life, not just the podcasting, but with my, with my tattoo career and stuff like that, whether they would have sat there and been, do you know what, I made a mistake about that. I'm glad he's doing all right. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know if people do. I don't know if people cheer you on from the background anymore, do they? There's certain, I think that's why you keep your circle small now, don't you? Because the people that build you up is the ones you really want to hang on to.
I learned that after me, brother.
Yeah.
After I lost my brother, my circle under halved, mate. Like, I literally went from, there were so many of us, and it just completely just went down. Smaller circle is way better.
Well, yeah, much better.
Much better. Better.
I learned that in the hard way through surviving what I did, that I think that I believe myself. I survive so much, it makes me more of a dangerous man.
Mm.
Because I can be at one with myself, I can enjoy my own company more, dangerously more than I ever need anybody. So my circle went, well, I used to have a massive, well, I thought it was a massive circle, and it probably was in a way.
And that's the thing. You think that everyone's your friend.
Yeah.
You think. And it's not until you sit there and you think to yourself, I actually liked you, and you hurt me.
Yeah.
Because they don't want you for your friendship. They want you for what you've got, for what's around you, do you know, the name that you have within your town or your neighborhood. That's what they want. They don't actually want you. It's not until something bad happens or you end up going away for a little bit that no one's ringing your phone.
Yeah.
No one's checking you're okay. You just bounce back to the street like a year, 2 years later, and everyone's like, oh, you're all right. I ain't seen you for ages.
Yeah, you see you're back. Yeah. I say the same thing. I used to sit there when I compare, because my thing was I moved to Portsmouth.
Yeah.
4 years ago now in September. When I went there, it was my biggest lesson, because it was the second time, apart from when I went to Devon, the second time I moved out of my manor. And then even my closest people, that phone didn't ring no more. Mm-hmm. I was walking down the beach on my own with my dog, thinking, fuck me, like, there's no one on the end of this phone no more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally didn't ring. And I thought, I ain't chasing people. And people just dropped off as easy as that the minute I wasn't about. Mm-hmm. But my other thing was, so when I was in the manor, I used to say to people like this, it was the cherry. So as soon as I had the cherry, I didn't even get to buy it because all these fake-ass friends bit it. I was just left with a stalk every time, thinking, fucking hell.
Yeah.
That was my life.
Yeah, it's true. Absolutely true. Same for me. I was about, everyone knew me, everyone said hello, everyone things. And I think I just gained respect through fear. And that was a rude awakening. Because when I moved away, like you said, I had no phone, no phone calls, no nothing. My phone used to go off all the time.
Yeah.
What are you doing? What are you up to? Oh, party at mine tonight. People would come around at the weekend. We'd have parties at mine. They'd be crashed out on the floor and all that lot. And same again tomorrow. Yeah, sweet, come over.
Yeah.
And as soon as all that lot stopped, everyone disappeared.
Well, so did you move from somewhere to here?
I moved from here up to Newcastle.
Okay.
So when I left here, because I was on the run from the police and that at the time, all the people that I thought were my boys...
left you on your ass.
Yeah, left me on my ass.
Yeah.
So then when I come back, when I moved back like 6.5 years later, I'd gone away. I took myself away from all of the poison and I was living in a council house, living day by day, just doing my thing. Didn't have a job. I was just wheeling and dealing and knuckle diving and stuff like that, you know, and I was doing all that lot. So I was about all the time. So people were always at my house and I'm always like game to go and do anything because I didn't have a job. So that's where I was. But then when I moved away, I grew up fast because I was in a town now. I didn't know nobody. I couldn't duck and dive. So I couldn't do anything.
Yeah, network's gone.
Everything's gone. Everything that I knew, what I'd had to teach myself because I never learnt this anywhere else, you know what I mean, on how to make money. It was all gone. So I then got myself a job. And the 6.5 years I was away, I bought a house. I bought a brand new car from BMW. Do you know what I mean? I brought, I was going on holidays and all stuff that I'd never done when I was here. And I think to myself, I did have a poisonous woman in my life at that time. Yeah. And she didn't help me whatsoever with like progression of life. You know, it was just like, there were the stages that I did. I mean, if you ask her, she'll tell you it's because of her, this all happened. Do you know what I mean? Like, but I had to stand up to the plate and do all that lot. But if I'd have stayed here in that 6.5 years, I'd have probably been in jail. Yeah. I'd have probably done so much stuff. I would have lost everything. Do you know what I mean? So I think taking yourself away from the comfort of ease, because it's easy to just sit on your sofa and chill with your friends and have a beer and stuff. Like when you know what the estate's like. You just, you one minute you're around someone's house. But it's easy to forget like how many hours there is in the day and what you need to progress in that day.
Yeah.
You just forget it. I'll do it tomorrow.
Is that, yeah. It's always, you know tomorrow.
What I mean? Yeah.
But see, I done that now. When in 2007 when I moved to Devon, that was my first time actually trying to get away from Norfolk and that, because if I didn't have done that then, and then we're going to the story what happened to me from there, I would probably have been the same, in jail or been dead, because my criminal lifestyle was getting so big, not so big, but I always had the right connections to do the right things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing so much deep shit, like with a business brain on me, because I had the Palletways thing, and that created, that enhanced more from a street mentality business brain from drugs or whatever I used to do. It went on to Palletways, then I see big money, and it took me into, when that was sort of coming to an end, it coming into bigger crime, because I'd always look for an opportunity, whatever it was, and it became dangerous in big leagues, if you know what I mean. So.
Yeah, because of course, you when you're earning big money, I don't get it. When you haven't got any money, you appreciate the doing the nothings that cost for free. Do you know what I mean? Like you go over the park, you go for a walk, you go for down the beach. You know what I mean? You have that family time of like, you know, having that, like, you know, pissing around and just doing your thing. Yeah. When you have money, you no longer start doing the things that are free. And I don't know why, because when it comes on top, they're the things that you miss and you appreciate the most.
Yeah, of course.
But you end up, oh, we just go out, instead of just making a sandwich at home and then taking it down the beach, you end up going, oh, we'll just go out for dinner. And look, you end up eating dinner, sitting in restaurants, wasting your time just sitting with people that you don't even really want to be around, you know, forgetting that you could have just got some chips, sat on the beach and thrown them at the seagulls, you know? You know, that kind of stuff.
Just living in the moment.
Yeah, again. just that stuff.
But I'll ask you that then. That's something I've always wanted to ask somebody as it goes. And we're here today, so why not? When you realise at times that, is that because we were council estate kids and to have that? Because I'd done all the same. I always wanted the best of everything, yet I was quite humble. I was quite content with doing the things that you said, because that's what I like. And I hate it when people say to me, yeah, I want to get a new car on this Merc. I want to get this car and finance, or like top of the Range Rover, whatever. Or I want this AP watch. And I think to myself, like, fucking hell, that it doesn't bring, like we said earlier, when you strive for it, you get it. But I would never, ever strap myself up on finance to be paying that off just to what? To either 100%. Get robbed or look good.
Yeah.
Because that don't impress me as a person. What impresses me is this good old-fashioned conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the real shit in
100%.
Life. 100%. And so when you... Why did we want that? Why from council? Because it was it through being deprived that we wanted these? Because it was such a cool thing to have all the
I think the top era, stuff the era that we grew up. Yeah, I think the era you grew up, because I know loads of kids. My family, most of my family is still on the council estate now, and I go back there all the time. Yeah. When we were younger, we had so many role models that were positive. Yeah, yeah. That we chose to follow what we thought was the greater. Yeah.
Yeah.
That when we get it, we never actually chased our dream. We chased their life, their dream.
Yeah.
So when we then got what they had, what we thought that we wanted, it wasn't our dream in the first place. It was theirs.
Yeah.
They had the Ferrari. I want the Ferrari because they've got it, because I looked up to them. So when I got it, it meant nothing to me because it wasn't my dream.
Yeah.
My dream is this. Small talk with strange people, you know, just 1-to-1, 10-to-1, whatever it is, yeah? Just that free stuff that, you know, just taking time. How are you, mate? Are you good?
Yeah, exactly,
like taking the kids down the forest where it costs not a single penny to go, you know? Taking the dog for a run. You know, the dog running and knocking your kid over and just be like, oh, you're all laughing about it. And then your kid's telling the dog off and it's just hilarious, you know? You can't put money on any of that.
You can't buy that.
But that's a memory that stays there forever.
Yeah, I say the same now. I said this a little while, a few years back, when someone said the same thing we're talking about now. I said, you could lock me up and throw away the keys, and I've got a flicker pad in my mind of fucking memories upon memories. And so what else do I need? Because everything else, we're going to die. No, none of this shit comes with us, no matter what you got. But whatever goes on after this, whatever I die with in my dying bed, I just sit through that flicker pad in my mind, and everything you're saying there is just making that memory.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. It's not about things. It's about memory.
Yeah.
And this is where I've come to now. Was taught me probably the same as yourself.
Mm.
So yeah, from a
it's,
criminal.
It's been
life
a very too. Expensive lesson.
Oh yeah.
But I think when a lot of people, hopefully, they'd hear like our version of how it is that what we've just said. And that'll make them wake up a little bit. I thought to myself, you know, when the whole pandemic thing went on and people were losing their houses and they were losing their cars and they were losing, like, just their life, yeah? I wonder how many people sat back and goes, I've worked so hard for that and they just took it away from me and realised that, hang on a minute, that weren't actually mine in the first place. I financed it. I'm not saying that it's bad to finance something.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just saying that. They've worked so hard for things that weren't them that actually meant nothing because people just took it away.
Yeah.
Where, like you said, you got the memories, the flicker pad, it's there. No one can take that away.
No one can take that.
Nobody can take it.
And you could, and I sat there in the pandemic myself with no work and thoughts was, my thoughts on that was, if I lost it all tomorrow, I've had it all, I've lost it all, I've had it all, I've got it back again, I've lost it all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't give two shits.
Yeah.
I'm just as happy living in a studio flat and still smile every day.
Oh, mate, I'd live in a tent in a forest, mate. I would too, but I don't need the house. I don't need the cars. No, I don't need anything.
I don't need things.
I just need to see the smile on my kid's face and just make sure the missus is all right. And just like, you know, when I say all right, I don't mean like financially all right. Just make sure that we're all okay. Like you like waking up in the morning. It's good.
Health-wise,
you know?
Happiness-wise. Yeah. No, I get it. I get it totally.
That's me, mate.
Yeah,
that's me, and I wish I would have realised that the dream that I wanted back then was so easily achievable. I didn't have to break my back to get it.
When you look
back, because it's just there.
Well, like exactly the story I said to you. Forgetting all the underworld stuff, when I had my opportunity then, I could have invested wisely, or been the best at what I was at, and I'd be enjoying life wherever I was in the world now. But whatever set out for us is set out for us. So I needed all that for a lesson.
Mm.
So I believe everything's for a lesson, good or bad. And I learn from everything now.
Yeah, 100%.
So, and I like what you said there, yeah, because it's true. Because I say that a lot, because not a lot of people say that. Some people say, oh, yeah, I'm not materialistic. 9 times out of 10 people, unfortunately, are.
Yeah.
Because it is about, you're trying to impress someone with what you have or what you've got.
Of course.
And it's not, that's not actually.
And the problem that you've got with that, yeah, is if you think that you're not materialistic, whether it's clothes or whether it's objects of like, you know, metal, like cars and watches and all that lot. Unfortunately, like if you was to go and try and find love and you say you had a twin, a perfect identical twin. And you're wearing just basic nothing, just no branded nothing. And your twin is like all spiced up, looking fresh, you know, £1,000 outfit on or whatever. It's more than likely that girl would pick the person that's looking the freshest.
Yeah, 100%.
When the person that doesn't is probably the right one for her.
Well, my pal, he's got a wicked trust fund and all that. He's born into money, but he drives just a Ford Focus, I think it is, or Mondeo. I don't know what it is. Fairly new one. And he said the same thing. Like, we just had a conversation once, and it was one like, it's something that's always stuck with me from someone that could have anything. I've been away with him and everything. I think his trust fund's ridiculous. He said to me, I'd rather someone, a girl or a friend, see me for me than I ever would to spend money on things and then that's never real.
Mm.
He said, if I'm rocking down the road in what I am, people are only going to see me. I don't have to have anything else, and that's going to attract the right people.
Yeah, that's exactly.
The truest thing I've ever, and I've never forgot that. It was only 3 years ago, but it's really stuck with me that.
Yeah, good. And I'm glad that's like something that he's managing to push out to people that understand it. Because like you said, if he's got a trust fund, he can have anything he wants. But that, you've got a bird that if anything happened to him, so like he died, his bird's probably going to jump straight onto the next guy that's got money so she ain't going to mourn you because she didn't actually want you. She wanted what you had.
That's the root of all evil, isn't it? So 100%. It brings that into your life as well. So. Yeah, funny old game.
Yeah.
But I like this. I like good old-fashioned conversation as well. So
yeah, man, it's 100. I'd have it. You can't put a price tag on it. It's brilliant.
No chance, you can't.
So you ended up down in Devon.
Yeah, so trying to get out of London of my lifestyle. That was October when it happened. So I think early 2007, I can't remember the exact date, was my move to Devon now. My mum had moved there a year previous to Brixham. So I went down, I was looking in painting. So I brought my mum's council house off her, done it all up, because I've always been in it, like, after the transport company, I was always in a building game. I changed, done a loft conversion, all the standard things, and the house boom. I think it was 2007, houses were booming in London. Not as much as it went on to, but at that time. So I thought, I'll go to Devon, be with my mum. Always fancy living by the seaside.
Yeah.
And obviously just, I knew things were going to go bad if I stayed where I was. So that was my get out clause. So I went down there, took on a mortgage, looked in painting, found a really nice, like the roads had palm trees, just a beautiful place it was. So brought this house and I was down there, couldn't get work because you're saying about the network thing now all of a sudden, I don't know. No one.
It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, try and get a normal job. There's like 30, 40 people going for one job. So I thought, I had a couple of quid from the house, so I just went out jet skiing every day. First thing I'd do was buy a jet ski. I used to tow it down on my own, go out jet skiing, and just enjoy that sea life for a bit. And then, my uncle would move down there prior, my mum's brother, who was always like a black sheep of the family. But he was a builder, I was a builder. So he was a landscape gardener. So he said, why don't you come into this game? We'd do it together. So we came quite close when we was down there. I was quite close to him when I was young as well. Funny enough, when I was in care, he used to take me for weekends and he was like my favourite uncle. And then we'd lost touch for years. So I moved down there, started spending a lot of time with him. And so what was that now? So 2 or 3 months in now, living down there, the missus couldn't find a job. So I think we was doing like an online market store or something that she was doing online selling stuff anyway. And I was going sea fishing with my uncle, and the build up to it was when we're sea fishing, first sign of it anyway, he used to pull out this little notepad out of his thing. So tell her, you recognise these number plates? That's why you're sea fishing. Do you know what I mean? Because I've always been a bit of a witty guy and a laugh, I never really take anything seriously.
Yeah.
Or look for any danger in anything. I said, what are you talking about, Vince? He's like, well, because his car registrations keep following me. I was like, fuck, get the fuck out of here. What are you on about? You fucking, don't worry about all that. Let's just carry on fishing. So, like, there's a few little signals that I wish I'd picked up on earlier, but I didn't have this mindset then. Do you know what I mean? I just thought the geezer was crazy. You know what I mean? So, and then a couple of things he used to tell me, there's someone keep breaking in my house, messing around with my paperwork. I was like, that don't happen. Not in Devon. What are you talking about? Someone's going to mess your paperwork up, you know, of like whatever claim. Because ironically, he was burnt on a building site years ago with bitumen on a roof.
Right.
So we used to visit him in hospital when he was burnt. And he had a big insurance claim or whatever against the company and everything else. And this is the paperwork he reckoned someone was going through. And long story short, there's loads of little signs. I can't remember it all now. But now October 14th, 2007, I'm sitting here. I think a few weeks before that, we hadn't seen him for a few weeks. So I don't quite know what was happening with him then. He was already diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and stuff like that, but none of us knew. It was all kept from us by my auntie and everything else. So October 14th now, he's just turned up out of the blue randomly. I was sitting there reading an auto trader. I'm still looking for this tipper truck because I'm
going to... Auto trader? Fuck.
Do you remember that?
Oh, my God.
That and the exchange of mark.
99p?
Yeah.
Yeah.
99p. Yeah, that's what I had literally in my hand at my dining table. He came in for a cup of tea. Oh, no, he turned up, had a cup of tea, and then he was getting on about these paranoid delusions again. I said, Vince, man, you're going to have to go. I don't know what you're really on about. And then he's going, oh, right, I'll forget about it. Because he's saying, see that letter on the side from Essex? I was like, yeah, my ex is from Essex. They're all after me over this claim money. I was like, no one's after you, Vince. He said, yeah, but you keep going to London and back. Yeah, because I'm fucking from London. That's what I do. Yeah, but these car registrations. And I said, look, you're going to have to go. He said, well, I just let me next week. I've got last week's auto trade. Let me get out for you before I go, and we'll leave it like and I'll go and whatever. I'm sorry and all that. So that's sweet. He's gone out. So me and the missus looking at each other. She's cooking a Sunday roast, and she's rolled her eyes because she don't like him anyway. Paranoid of him. Says he always does strange things. Next thing, he's walked through the fucking door with a petrol can and the lid off of it, and a lighter in one hand, saying, "Now I want fucking answers to what's going on. What you lot doing? You're all guilty of this. It's only since you lot have been around me this is all happening." And I said, Vince, look, you ain't going to just put it down. You ain't going to do nothing. And he said, oh, fuck it. And he started pouring it over his own head. I'm sitting down at the dining table with an auto trader looking up at him pouring petrol over his own head. Then he splashed it towards me and he said, right, he's holding a lighter, still the petrol can. There's petrol everywhere now, by the way. He's saying, I want fucking answers to what you lot are doing. And then the missus was holding the dog. I said, Vince, I can't tell you what you don't know. You're just being fucking stupid. He said, you're going to die today. I'm taking you all with me and this, that and the other. The missus got the dog, some husky we had at the time, and the integral door now still at the back of the kitchen. She went to go out the door. He said, where the fuck do you think you're going? She said, I'm letting the dog out. He said, you ain't going anywhere. So he went for her. So then I jumped up out of my seat, and then we had just had the almighty fight, a big punch up. And with his petrol cans spinning amongst our feet, I could feel this petrol can running about, and where we've just like struggled and we've tussled in the fire or whatever, I was just hoping to give her enough time to get out. And then, but he smiled and lit the lighter. He looked at me and he was like holding me down at the same time, and he smiled, lit the lighter, and fucking hell, man, like boom. And let me just explain my house. When you used to come to my house, we was on a hill down overlooking the sea, so you'd come into the kitchen, dining room and garage, down to the living room, up to the bedrooms. So I'm sort of kind of on the first floor. So within that, it's like I've seen out a backdraft, the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So it just felt like it took everything off you, the heat, the intensity of it. So all I could see was a ray of light coming off my balcony. And it wasn't really a balcony. It was just slidey doors with a rail. So I've gone to jump for that whilst trying to pull him with me. But he's like a dead weight, so I had to just let go, jump over the balcony, because I'm on fire. So I've jumped off the first floor, rolled on the floor, pulled all my hoodie off because now this thing is it's intense. And then literally, I had a pair of Adidas. Remember the old shell suit bottoms?
Yeah.
So after the hoodie and top come off, I literally left with a waistband of that, my boxer shorts, half burnt socks, and my trainers with all burnt laces. And I thought, fucking hell. And all I could hear was like moan and groans coming from out there. So I run back up my house. I can't get in the kitchen because it's like the flames are ridiculous. I've gone out the front door, but I've seen the garage open. I've run in the neighbour's house, Karen or whatever her name was, and I said, I splashed water in my face, and the missus said, what the fuck happened there? What the fuck? I was like, I don't know, let me just put some water in my face. And at the time, I didn't even feel that bad. I was like red, all my hair had gone, because I used to have like nice styled hair and that. So I literally had no hair left, and I was just a bit red. And then everyone was saying, get out of the house, because this fire was so intense. The whole street's out now. I've gone out the front, sat on the pavement. An old lady, all I remember, was putting wet towels over me. And I thought, he ain't come out. Do you know what I mean? I said, has anyone seen him? Like, he ain't made it out. Next thing, I didn't know the petrol keeps burning. So the best way I can explain it was like a scene out of RoboCop, because my skin started dripping. Like, I could feel things on my ears. My skin was just dripping down, like, off my ears. My fingers were like, there was skin hanging. And then my body just started getting into shock when I was sitting there. And I could, you know, when you're trembling, I couldn't control it. Next thing, an ambulance has come, put me in that. They pulled, all I remember was a big injection. And by that point, I started feeling a bit like, you know, you start seeing the light.
Yeah.
It's a true thing, because I was literally seeing the light.
Well, you felt like you was dying.
Yeah, definitely felt like, because my body was doing some shit it's never done in its life. I don't know what, I couldn't control it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And the minute they give me the injection, I was still conscious in parts. They got me to Torquay Hospital. And I remember my dad being at the side of me, but they had me in a big tent. Because I was so open wounds, I think.
So I was
in this tent and I could see all these madness, all the nurses rushing around and everything. I said to my dad, I don't think I'm going to make it. He said, you are. And he was all choked up and crying and all that. And I thought, I'm not definitely not going to make it. And the madness that I see. And then I just said to him, tell my kids, say I love them. And he said, you're going to make it. You're going to make it. Next thing, I don't really remember much because they put me in the coma from there, drove me to Bristol French Air in and out because I was supposed to be airlifted. But I don't think they could get the heli, whatever the story was. They took me to Bristol French Aid in a like super speed ambulance, whatever, or however fast. And then I just remember bits of that, in and out of like consciousness. And I at one point I was joking. I felt like I was still all right. But everyone around me kept crying. I kept hearing people, family members and friends. It was like a scene out of Godfather. That's when I thought I had hundreds of friends at that point, because there was loads of people. I could hear everyone, familiar voices, all crying though in corridors and all that. And I was thinking, fucking hell. So my version of it was, upon arrival there, what I do remember hearing all of that, all I remember is raving in the basement with slush puppies and teddy bears for days upon days, because I was so morphined up, I was tripping out my nut. So when they used to bring me out, they'd say, don't put me, whatever you're doing. I said, all these nurses are wheeling me down to the basement every night having slush puppy parties and I can't get out of this fucking bed. I said, no, you're not, actually, you haven't moved. You've been asleep for days and all that. But I was literally splintered up because they had to do so many emergency operations, like skin grafts on my legs because I was so open. All my arms were grafted. My neck was grafted from my top of my chest to my neck. And so they had tracheostomy. And so at one point, I couldn't even talk. I had to point at numbers. So, like, the only thing I can explain about that's obviously I had a couple of dreams now because I can't really talk what I don't remember about them points, only what people tell me. But before they woke me up, I think they was telling me, like, there was a nurse and he was talking to me saying, do you know what happened and everything else? And I said, yeah, because I still remembered it all. But I think they were just testing what you can remember, what you can't. And they released a balloon in your tracheostomy so you could talk. And I thought, fucking hell, I can talk again. And he said, do you want to see a mirror?
They do that gradually, didn't they?
Yeah, I think so.
So let a bit of air out just to you to get used to it again. Yeah, so you don't get in a shock. Yeah.
And, but I just remember all these machines around me because everything failed on me, like all my organs. It was the burns, but where I went in so open wounds, MRSA, C. diff, septicemia. I caught every superbug because Bristol French Aid at the time was the second worst hotel,
right?
It was proper Hotel California. You know what I mean? You can book in, but you can't leave. But it was the worst hospital in the UK, one of the worst in the UK. So I caught every super bug, and that's what more or less done me. Because every organ failed, basically. So every machine kept me alive. They read my final rites twice. So I'll go through that bit before I talk about waking up. And then they said to me, what was it they said to me? I can't remember what they said now. They said, can't even remember where I was going with that bit, but... Well, with all the, they read my final rites twice. My sister threw the priest out the second time because she said, he ain't dying, get out. And it was just one nurse or one surgeon who had the last idea to save my life, because on the second time now, they're not going to do no more. Nothing they can do for me, because all my lungs were filled with fluids.
Could you hear all of this?
No, I couldn't hear none of it. Not that I remember. So, because I was in a drug-induced coma for... I think about 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah, they say sometimes, like, when someone's in a coma, you can go and read to them or go and speak to them or play music, and apparently you can hear it, but I.
Yeah, I didn't hear. I know, what I do remember, I didn't hear nothing, except for the things that I told you when I first went in. So what I do remember is after the first time that they read my final rites and held a chapel arrest service for me, the first time when I was written off, until they put some more machines on or whatever. I remember they brought me out of it, and I said to my family, I was knocking on your door last night. They said, what are you talking about? I said, yeah. They said, how'd you get to the room then? And then I explained it and got it, but never been that place in my life. It got it wrong by one door. And they're all looking at each other like, how the fuck does he know that, whatever. But gospel truth, I remember getting out of my bed, whether I was tripping or not, but I just can't not look at it because I got it wrong by one door. I've never left.
So you reckon that you had an out-of-body experience where your spirit left and then you went and just done your trip?
I think so. Well, how else would I know that? So, yeah, I believe whatever it is, whether my spirit left its body at the time or whatever, yeah, it's definitely an out-of-body experience of some sort.
Wow.
I couldn't have consciously done that in a hospital, I don't know. But let me not finish on that one. That was just a light one. Then the second time, when they threw the priest out, because I didn't want to turn my machines off, the surgeon come up with the last idea, let's turn him on his front, because he's got pneumonia and everything so bad, through my tracheostomy, they're having to suck out all the fluids and everything. They turned me on my front, so I could use the back of my lungs to breathe. That was my final chance of living. And it worked. So 2 days after that, they brought me back out of the coma again. And I said to the missus, and my mum, I think it was, or my dad, I can't remember who was there. I said, yeah, I was out having a meal with Nan and Granddad last night, bearing in mind they've been dead years. They said, well, where did you go then? I said, there's a nice little restaurant up the road there. It's like a cafe outside with little gold black rails around it and all that. Yeah, oh yeah, what did they look like? I said, well, it was all dressed in white. I took a white Ferrari convertible from the front. What does the front look like? I said, well, I left. They said, how'd you leave your room? I said, well, I went through that door there. Out the front, there's a half circle where it was parked. I got in it, went down to the end of the road, through them actual gates, left, and I met them up in a cafe up there. The calf didn't exist. There was nothing up there. But how I explained the front was to a T how I got into my bed.
Wow.
And I come from ICU to that room after the second time. So I was in intensive care, never left there until I got to that part. And then but that was really real to me, because when they pushed me out later on and I see it in real life, I was physically sick, because it was so how I see it. Yet I've never seen that place in my life.
That's mental.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And my granddad telling me it's not your time yet, boy. So that was the last thing, the only part of the conversation I remember. And I come back into my bed, park back in a half circle, walk back in, told him exactly how I walked into my bed and where my bed was. So that was pretty mad. So
you had to have had, there's no other way to describe it. I mean, you know, you're going to get people that go, actually, you don't have our body experience. You must have just been semi-awake as they were wheeling you in and you'd have seen it.
I come in the back door, though.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's the car park.
That's the only way that you can explain that, because of the amount of drugs that you were on, yourself, you're holding on, but in turn, you're tripping so much that you're allowing yourself to be outside your own body.
Yeah.
Whether that's shock, drugs, or trauma, bro, you had an out-of-body experience.
100%, yeah. And I believe that. Well, I see it. It's not like I'm living proof that it's not something I'm just going to say if I didn't experience it. Do you know what I'm saying?
And yeah, I think you definitely experienced it.
Yeah.
How can you get two things right minus one door,
and they've got no calf. Exactly. And I say the same today. So when someone says to me now, if you used to turn around to me, he's like, are you scared of death? Not really. Because if I've seen that on my death's door, then there's got to be something else, isn't there? Because there's got to be more to this world than there is. Do you know what I mean? So I was probably always a person, a normal guy, like, yeah, I don't really want to die.
I think once you take that fear away from someone, there's nothing else to be scared of. I think once you take away the fact that you've experienced death and you've come out of it, so your experience of death seems to have been pretty beautiful because you've been able to navigate whilst you've been borderline dead. You've been able to navigate your mind and your spirit wherever it is that you needed it to be. Yep. So you're living you're living outside your human aesthetic, entity, to be able to carry on living. So you've got no fear of it because you had a beautiful experience.
Yeah, well, I stared death in the face and it was beautiful. So that's the only way I can explain it, because it was quite a nice drifting in another world.
So okay then, now you've took away the fear of life. Do you see the fear of death? Do you see the beauty of life?
Yeah, 100%, man. I look at life in a whole different way now. That, like I said, it's probably in my life I wouldn't appreciate looking at trees and greenery or being by the sea now.
The free stuff.
Yeah, the free stuff. But the beautifulness in that free stuff, because that is really...
That's appreciation of free, that is.
Yeah, it really is. I appreciate a lot more things now that I'll probably never take notice of in my life. And actually speaking to people and having time to share stories and talk old stories with older people. Do you know what I mean? You know, things that where I was an arrogant whatever before. Do you know what I mean? I was a pretty boy and I was so arrogant, so up my own arse. I don't know where my life would have went like that. So I needed this to change me as well. So maybe all this had to happen to make me a better person and to be able to give me something to give others. Do you get what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I look at it.
Do you hate him for what he did?
Yeah,
considering you've just said about without that, you would never have been able to find the beauty within your life.
So I'll go on with the story in a sec. But I'll just give you this as you ask that question now. So I don't forgive because I don't think I know how to forgive. And I don't think it's something, and you'll know why in a minute when I go on with the story. But I can't forgive him for one thing. So it's a strong word that I was asked that by the psychiatrist and everything. You should forgive and move on.
I've been told that.
Yeah, I can't forgive, no. Mm. And I won't forgive because if he had survived, I wouldn't be able to do this now because it would have been my life mission to probably torture the guy and I'm just being real.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd have ever let that go. Mm. I couldn't have let it go. But at the same time, he doesn't enter my mind space. I can sit here today and talk about it. He doesn't have no bearing or hold
power
on my life whatsoever. You're gone. Good riddance to you. But I won't. I'll never forgive him, no. I can't. And I'll tell you for why I can't forgive him, because after that second time, and I said they woke me up, I shared that story of crossing over, is where my real battle started now, because obviously they put me back under again for a few days. Because I think whatever happened after that, where they had me on my front, long story short, is they turned me over and I had catheters and everything, and they erupted the main blood vessel in my bum. So I had to go down for another surgery, so they put me under again, because everything there just went wrong for me. So now, the actual day, they're waking me up for good now. They've woke me up. I'm sitting there. I think, I don't know if he's passed me in the mirror yet or whatever. I think that, no, it wasn't. So I woke up. I'm in splints, but now I can talk. Even though I've got the tracheostomy in that. Now they're trying to bring me, like, let's build him up as a person. Now I've woke up, remembering all I remember, but in my bed now, my bedside, is my ex-missus and my sister. So now I'm confused because I thought, what's going on here then? And they're both pretty upset. So I was like, well, I thought this is they woke me up, say goodbye or whatever. My day's done, my journey's done now, whatever. And I said, what's the matter with you lot? And they said, oh, just build yourself up a little bit and everything else, sit up and do you want a drink? I was like, not really, I just want to know what's going on. Do you know what I mean? And they said, well, Atlanta just died, which is my daughter with my ex. So while I was fighting for my life, she was fighting for us in another hospital in London. So it was, yeah, sorry, man. Never really got me before. So, yeah, when they told me that, my whole battle really started there, if you know what I mean. Because I couldn't physically grieve, if you know what I mean. I couldn't, because I was in splints and I couldn't even walk. I'd been laid up for so long, I was physically couldn't move. I was, you know what I mean? I was in catheters and all that, and had to do it all in the, as you lay or whatever. And they pushed me, they actually wheeled me outside. The nurse said, let's wheel him outside, because I was on oxygen tanks and whatever else, so he can get a bit of fresh air. And all I remember is that night when they took me out, it was like a winter's night, and I managed to, you know, like when you can taste air, you're saying about three things. You can breathe in that. Like I could taste and smell the air that I've never smelt before on a misty night or whatever. Do you know what I mean? So from that night, they took me back in. I think the next day, do you want to look at yourself? They passed me a mirror. But I could no longer think of what has happened to me. It's like I couldn't be there for her. You know what I mean? So, and before that, I didn't know all the dramas. They barred the ex from the hospital because if they'd have told me, because she died a little bit before that. But if they'd have told me, it would have killed me. That's what they said, because he's so weak. Any bad news now? So it was a big risk to tell me at that point.
Yeah.
So they told me that. And then that was it, brother. I couldn't. Everything I was doing, physio, like as a man, 28 years old, all I want to do now, I know I'm going to have a funeral. So my, where we say you've got something to fight for now, something to achieve, they're telling me, you know, you might not walk again properly because your legs are so, you know, like we're so weak, we've laid up and we took skin grafts, your hands might not move again, your face and neck might not move because of how it all had to heal in positions. Yeah. All I want to do is walk for this funeral. For my daughter's funeral, I can't have nothing less than that. So this is again where we go back to, now I've got something to fight for. So every day I'm going physio. I remember they took me out of my bed for the first time. My legs were like jelly. I was dizzy. I was crying my eyes out as a man, crying my eyes, thinking like, not because of the grieving thing right now, but because I can't fucking feel anything I ever was. I was fit as a fiddle. I used to always be, once you take normal things away from yourself, that you got to literally learn to walk again, learn to talk.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
All stuff we take for granted on a daily basis.
Yeah, exactly that. The free, just health in general. The minute you can't itch your own head or you can't go to the toilet or whatever. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, that was. So, from that, I think it was before Christmas. Or was it Christmas? Because when they woke me up, there's Christmas cards everywhere. So I thought I'd miss Christmas, if you know what I mean. And that's one of my favourite times of the year.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was. The funeral was before Christmas, basically. So. Or it might have been just after, I can't really remember now, but I had to get, in my mind, ready for that. And from them battles was a lot of funny stories as well, do you know what I mean? Like, just things like being in the hospital bed, ringing the buzzer, no one coming, so I used to piss over the side of the bed on everyone's shoes that used to come and visit, couldn't wear the shoes in the room and all that. And I remember I said to the missus once, I need to go to a toilet. I want to use the proper toilet now, because now I'm getting frustrated. I want to do normal things. And she took me, I had the catheter and all that in the end of your willy, whatever. And I gone there and I couldn't walk properly. So I dropped, that thing's pulled out, it's ripped my thing. And we're both sitting there, I'm bleeding. And I said, don't tell the nurses we went to the toilet. Do you know what I mean? Like, things that was just going on was just funny in the end, like trying to get ready. But I'll fast forward now. There was some funny times, don't be wrong, because I'm not one to conform. But fast forward now to this funeral. I was still an inpatient or half an outpatient, still in Bristol. So they said to me, you can go with nurses because now I'm addicted to oxygen. Do you know, if you're on it too long?
Yeah.
So I can't.
That's why you could probably feel the fresh air and taste it and that, because it was different to what you've been.
Yeah, just being. Because they let me take the mask off for a second. Yeah, but it was such a beautiful to taste that, man. It's just, we just go back to how beautiful life is because you don't really appreciate it. But. I forgot where I was going now. The funeral was coming up.
And you got addicted to oxygen.
I got addicted. So my only option to go to the funeral was, because they had a fundraiser for me, and I couldn't even leave the hospital because I was on so many machines still, that I couldn't even go to my own fundraiser that they wanted to do for me because I lost everything, like every bit of clothing or mainly most of my stuff in the house because it burned down. So my family, my friends and all that, I couldn't attend that. But the funeral was a couple of weeks later, so I used to sit there when no one was around, wean myself off it, just pull my mask off, suffocate until a nurse come running and put it back on me. Because my only option was to basically go with nurses with oxygen tanks in a wheelchair, and that weren't happening. That was not happening. So when it came to the point of me weaning off of everything and getting it all clear to actually being able to go, was the first day I ever walked, because I went there in a car from a wheelchair. My pals, I said, I want all black Range Rovers or whatever. They all laid on the Range Rovers and I wanted to drive, and they were laughing, you can't fucking drive. I said, no, I'm driving. And they all said, do it, man. And they sat in the back. So I drove for the first time, walked for the first time. But in a blessing, it was obviously, I found myself again that day. But going back to my uncle, you took that moment. I was never there for my loved one, and I can't get that back. So I have no last memories. Do you know what I mean? So that was, fuck the burns. That was everything. The loss outweighed it all.
Yeah, I can see why now. You could never forgive something that you would never get ever again.
No.
And
it's that moment. We're talking about moments earlier. You can never have that moment again because of one man's actions. But the same, do you know what I mean? But I've got to live with that. Maybe you feel it because you've had a loss. You have the things where, if I was there, could I have done any different?
I've thought that.
Do you know what I mean? You do, and that's the thing that's the most painful thing, I think, because grieving's grieving. But when like we're talking about now, if you was there, could you have maybe suggested to a better doctor or a better hospital? Do you know what I mean? It's all the unanswered things.
For you or for your little?
For her. If I was there as her dad, even to have them last moments, even. Do you know what I mean?
What was it that took her?
So when she was born, she had her intestines grew outside of her stomach.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what happened at that time, but she always had a few stomach problems. She was born premature, and it was just before her third birthday, I think it was. And I think her stomach poisoned her with inside. Do you know what I mean? So the fluids was running in her blood.
Yeah.
So we went to the coroner's report. There's never been a answer to it all, if you know what I mean. So I don't act. This is just what we're told. Again, in the coroner, I don't know if you've been to one of them. I don't actually know what the cause. It could have been negligent. Who knows? Mm. Do you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, she's not here now. And it wasn't the best way to go neither. So do you know what I mean? It's a bit painful as a father to think that, at least if you was there, shared that last bit. But I was fighting for my life, and my ex-missus was trying to get me transferred to London so we were together in hospital, sort of thing. But my family barred her, so.
Absolutely insane, isn't it? You never think, or you never imagine that your child would go before you, but going at the same time as you is
it's unthinkable, isn't it?
It does make you wonder. I don't know whether you're a religious person. I am around a lot of people that are religious, but I always question things like this where I think to myself, like, why? Because I know as a father that I would say, you've got two of us here on a table. Take me.
Oh, of course.
Do you know what I mean?
Of course. But I think that I think that strongly. I'm not religious, I guess, but I am. I don't know, because I do believe in... I believe in something.
Yeah,
I'm
with you on that.
I can't say what it is.
I'm with you on that.
But if that was the option, that why the fuck didn't you just take me? I was gone anyway.
Mm.
I was gone twice. Just if it was my life or hers, obviously any parent's going to say that. But why couldn't she have survived?
Yeah.
Why did I have to survive? And I beat myself up a lot of years. I tried to take my own life over it like many times. I sat there once with a shotgun under my chin and was going to blow my own fucking brains out over it. Only because a friend knew where I was, because I made a couple of goodbye calls, and he figured out where I was, is that actually I got saved, it got pulled out my hand. But it went on for a long time, more because it wasn't, the burns really, they affect you in your physicality or, you know, body confidence, do you know what I mean? And I have had that, but at that, it was more to do with them moments and the things, like you said, the things you can't change.
Mm.
And why did I survive? That was one of my biggest things. Why couldn't it took me? Whatever it is. Why didn't you just take me and leave her? I've had 28 years. That's better than nothing, wasn't it? Better than 3 years.
I'm with you on that, man.
Mm.
I think some of us are here for the message.
Yeah.
I believe that some of us are here for the message. I'm not saying by the time we get to the message, we ain't going to deal with a whole lot of fucking pain in between.
Yeah.
And from what you just said, you're a testament to yourself with the pain that you've had to endure to be able to say this message today and many, many other times that you've done in the past, you know?
Yeah.
You know, are we here? Are we supposed to, is this what we're supposed to, are we supposed to be doing it? Is it what we're supposed to be doing? Or is it that we've just got to a point now where we're allowing ourselves to believe that we are here for the message, that we just carry on doing it? And with that, do we, what, for what purpose are we doing it? And are we doing it for the reason it should be? And that is to help spread awareness, or are we doing it to try and take our mind away from the grief that we've done as a form of dealing with our trauma, you know? And I don't think there's a therapist out there that could ever answer that, because I think we adjust ourselves as humans to be able to learn how to cope and manifest the information that's negative, put into us, and try and put it out there in a positive. And with that, we start finding our own journey, and that's finding ourselves in the process. Yeah. And that allows you to open up your mind to believe that what we are doing is right, not just for others, but for our soul.
Yeah, of course.
And then the gift that we get from that is the realization of appreciation.
Yeah.
And that's hard to visualize, or to even put, that was hard for me to put that in words that I would even understand, because it's so hard. I sit here and I think all the time, you know, and I struggle with the words on how to say it now, where you'd understand what I'm going through and I'd understand what you're going through enough for the viewers to be able to see, you know, the trauma that has been put there. And I think if we was all learn how painful it was to have a positive message at youth, at school, and we was talking generational knowledge earlier on before we started this about what we're led to believe is right.
Well, the world be a beautiful place. I always thought that. I always thought, you know, like, I had a big heart anyway, but after everything, it did the same as what you're thinking there is exactly the same. When I'd done everything I did, go on to the charity and everything else, I realised, though, that not everybody else had that message around me.
Mm-hmm.
So although I was running with a lantern, everybody else wasn't really running with me.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody liked the idea of it.
Yeah.
Because they haven't really experienced it. I only clicked with people like yourself or people that's been through some stuff, because all roads to recovery touch each other along the way or lead to the same path. So I could only really, I think I inspired a lot of people. I know that I have some, and I only really wanted to inspire a handful of people, but it did help me a lot, because I've got to get it out of my system, talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been through the crying stages. I've been through like the hardened stages and everything else. And my journey was exactly the same. I just wanted to help people. But then another thing I come across is that I could only help some of the people some of the time, not all of the people all the time.
Have you reached a selfish part yet?
As in,
like, you've done so much and you've inspired me from day dot. I said that from the beginning. Have you got to the selfish part yet where you're like, no one's actually really paying attention? Why am I even bothering? I'm taking time out of my day. I'm doing this off my own back. And no, what have you got to that part yet?
I think I probably have a couple of times. Not in that sense, but in the sense of where I was telling my story, so I started to bore myself. So even today, it's kind of hard for me because I've lived it so many times. I don't feel that I can give you the best of it,
mm-hmm.
because I've rinsed it so many times, because it's only one story. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I know there's things that lead off from that. But I guess at them points, I started to feel selfish in myself. Is that what am I trying to do here?
Yeah.
Because I'm repeating myself constantly, and I'm trying to help some people. Some people like light up my life, and I think, my God, I actually helped. And then some people, when you can't help someone because they're unhelpable, and I think, oh no. Like, and then I take all that negative things. So it used to make me up and down. So selfishly, I guess that's why I don't do it no more now. Why I said today this will be my last one, because I've sort of accepted, and this is another selfish thing, I guess, but I've accepted in my head that I've survived what I said earlier. So now I just want to move on. But I kind of like still miss that buzz of inspiring, because like you, I think it's my purpose and I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I got lost in it all through selfishness and whatever else. And I thought, I just want to go and make money now. I don't even want to talk about myself no more. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. I guess that was a selfish part, but I don't know how it hit me. But the minute you want to do something different, and I ain't got the love for it. And bearing in mind, I was the guy that sat in hospital in 2007, wishing that I just had another burn survivor guy come to my hospital bed, or someone that had been through something saying, "Listen, I was where you was, but this is, give me some hope." That's all I wanted, was some hope. So I wanted to be that hope to others,
mm-hmm.
which I've done many times.
Yeah,
but. So I don't know. Am I selfish? Because now I don't know that I feel the same anymore. Do you know what I mean?
It's crazy what you say when you said that no one come to me when I was about. I needed another burns victim to be able to come in and talk to me. I was the same with why I ended up doing what I'm doing now, and that's raising awareness on the trauma quick thinking, murder,
yeah.
Knife crimes, things like that. So I put into play what I'm doing. And I don't go on many podcasts and talk about my story, because it's not my story, it's my brother's story, and it's his legacy. I'm just dealing with the pain of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So as I've come down, I have never got to the point where I feel like I'm repeating the same story yet,
yeah.
because it's all still fresh. It's only 5 years, you know, and, I'm at the strength to be able to talk about it. I'm at the strength to be able to raise the awareness. But I know at some point, yeah, every single time I do something, it's going to harden me to the point where the rawness that I put out with what I say stops being seen.
Yeah.
And I think that might be where you're at with it, having that rawness now, because you spoke about it so much, it becomes so, you know, you've lived it and you've come stronger. So now you're living in your strength rather than living in your weak. So I think that you've built the strength up now that you are able to say, I've done my bit.
Exactly, yeah. I think you're right. And I think just something I wanted to say there is that when you actually sit up anymore talking about it, I was so far detached from, like, today is the first time it's choked me up in many years, where because I was like a robot. I could talk the story so many times. I detached it was like somebody else's story. Like what you just said there.
Yeah.
It was like I was always telling that story. And all I get, you know, like there's so much to it, and obviously we haven't touched on loads of it today, but there's so much road to recovery on it, and people related to it in every different parts of it. But when you no longer talk, it's like I'm talking, it happened to somebody else, then I'm so far detached from it myself that either I'm over it, or like you said, it's time to hang up the microphone, because it's how far do you go now? Because in interviews, there's no emotion no more. There wasn't any more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's when I think you have to, for me anyway, is that I think I'll just move on to... I love helping people, but at the same time, my heart's always going to be good in life anyway. There's other people outside of mental health and burns and whatever else, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? I could just be nice to someone in the street now.
Yeah, of course.
So I can always do good, and maybe... And I believe in the universe, so whatever's set out for me is set out. If something came back again later on and I could do something amazing, I'll do it. But it can't be just about...
That,
yeah, it can't be just about that same story there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and putting your, raising your awareness in what's happened to you and trying to be there for other people, you've got a point where, like you say, you have to detach yourself. So it is somebody else's story. So you're now in a position where you can now accept new things that come into your life,
yeah,
and probably appreciate them 10 times more than what you did when everything was before, you know. And for that, I guess you could be grateful that you're able to open your heart up to new things that are the next step, the next journey. for me, you would know this feeling because you've been where I'm at today. I'm not ready for new things yet because I'm still stuck reliving the memory because I'm trying to raise the awareness that you've done all of this. Yeah. I'm trying to raise the awareness and get that rawness out there that I ain't able to step away from this yet because I never grieved and this is my grief. This is me grieving from doing what I'm doing and raising awareness right across the platform with, like, you know, myself and knife crime, mental health, anxiety, depression, all of the above my channel covers, you know, and there's more things coming from the channel that's going to help raise the awareness right across the platform. You know, I've opened it right up for a lot of things to be able to help.
That's what I love about you as well, because, you know, when we connected and I see what you do, because I think that's needed for men especially. I know women, I'm not ruling out women, but men, it's only last few years, men, I was one of the first men, not I weren't one of the first, but in my whatever I see online,
yeah,
I was the first man to stand up and have body confidence issues and be looked down upon.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? You know, on my way up, I was like, yeah, here what? All these girls around, I've got body confidence issue as well. Let's do a photo shoot. And everyone was like, mate, man up. And I was like, no, fuck that. I'm not manning up. I want the same opinion as her.
Yeah.
I want to be that. I've got scars. I want to be body confident.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? But it wasn't, see, and I couldn't talk about mental health. If every man that wanted to come out would talk to me privately, but I couldn't interview another man about mental health because I was a victim of mental health.
Yeah.
And then suffered. Ironically, as a survivor, survived with mental, under a clinical psychiatrist for 5 years of my life, to fucking PTSD. I had panic attacks up until a few years back. Bad ones, night terrors and panic attacks where I thought I was dying all the time. So I've on the mental health side of it, that's why I've always said burns are mental health.
How was it for you going through all of, like, you building yourself up with being a burns victim and then suffering with the depression and that lot? Was it for you to go and speak to someone that opened up the whole pool?
No. My thing is, so I wrote my book and I put the – I think I was the first person I had to get signed off by the solicitor to put my clinical psychiatrist notes in my book.
Okay.
Because I put everything in there as it was. Whatever I talked about, it was in there. And she didn't want me to do it. But I wanted to show real. I've always been about being real.
Mm-hmm.
Don't care. But what actually helped me was writing that book from day one, because I had it ghostwritten. When I had to relive every moment of a guy asking me everything to put it into a book, that was the best therapy I ever had, was writing my life story.
Mm.
Not because I wanted to give, but by accident, really, I was just wanting to do that to put. So you had that in a hospital, just say. So if I couldn't be with you because, for obvious reasons, that some people don't want to see people, at least you had a book to read about that. Hear what you're sitting here today. You can't move. You've got to learn to walk again.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a guy that done it, and I'm just a man like you. I'm no one special. So you're going to get back to this as well. There's your bit of hope in a book. But writing that book, I didn't realize how much therapy that was. That was my best therapy by far. To a ghostwriter, to keep me laying on my phone, on my sofa, asking me so many questions and making me relive everything to put it into a book, I felt more a release after that, I think. I think that saying just, phew, it was gone.
It's good to talk.
It's good to talk.
It's okay 100%. Not to be okay.
100%. You have to accept that if you're not okay, you're not okay. Mm. And don't beat yourself up over it. I used to do it for years. I never left it. I was being a recluse. And then, but everyone around me used to say to me, you know, you need to go out more, you need to do that. No, it is all right not to be all right. That's what you've got to remember. But always to speak to someone and always confide in someone. Do you know what I mean? And that's.
Yeah, I done a podcast the other month with a guy, and he actually said it's okay not to be okay. And when he said that, I was like, wow, that was powerful. Then the other day, I was tattooing in my studio, right? And it was the wife of this gentleman that come in. Yeah. And he come in and he was hyped. He was like, I'm hoping to do a podcast with him later on with men's mental health. And he was hyped. He was like, I watched that podcast that you did. And for him to say it was okay not to be okay, he goes, it hit me. It hit me real hard. And to see someone take a positive out of that, just them words, yeah, makes you realise just how important it is to say the good things to people. Yeah. You know, because everyone's so quick to sit there and be like, ah, look at you. Ugh. You're horrible, you're fat, you're this, you're that, you know, and not realizing that's actually painful and it's cutting them and it's stepping them one step closer to possible suicide. Yeah, because of them words. You know, when you're a kid and a teacher, you'll never do nothing. You'll be a nobody. You're going to go to jail. Your parents, you're just a little shit. Get to your room. Or a girlfriend that you just didn't get on with. You're disgusting. You're horrible. Yeah. All of that stuff.
Sticks
even
in your
though
head,
you sit there and go, yeah, you should check you out then, and you try and laugh it off. But when you're there, and something bad happens, them are the things that come back. Them are the things that are playing with you. Them are the things that the psychiatrists are going to pull out of your head. And you're going to then start waking up and realizing that all of them words resonated with you so bad that it turned you into a downward spiral of mental health, where you're struggling to see the beauty within yourself.
But well, I studied this so much now, and even with my own psychiatric notes, is that this is a big thing that people forget, is that what psychiatrists actually do is work with you from childhood, because they gain a picture of what you are as a person. So if you always was a worrier and now you're suffering mental health, depression or whatnot, there's different ways for different people. Do you know what I mean? You probably come from what I come from. So this is why I said in the beginning that we sort of was resilient to a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So resilience is always going to be, if you're an outgoing character and you suffer with depression, the likelihood is you're going to get out of that a lot more easier than an inward character, mm-hmm. someone that's always suffered inwards. Mm. But there's help. There's what we can do as people is being out, you know, resilient or not, is just by talking. And just sometimes it just takes that one person to watch a podcast or watch, just to pick up, like you said there, on one word, because I've always said, my thing has always been never give up, no matter what. And it cannot rain forever. Whatever happens in your life, it cannot rain forever. And there's certain little things you just got to remember. And that's why people like us can do what we've done, or do what I've done and what you're continuing to do. Because without people like you that still continue, and then the next generation come up, who does anyone really have? Because that's all that really got me through, is watching other people talk and being part of the male movement in it. Because where you look back in the day, when would me and you be sitting here talking about stories?
Deep.
That's what I'm saying to you. Who would do that?
I never really heard anyone do that either when I was growing up. You know, like men just sitting there, like talking about real. Yeah. You know, like I never really heard none of that. It was always like football or what's going on down the park.
Alpha males.
The alpha side of it, men.
Yeah,
you know, what a false. What a false sense of security that was. Men are men.
Yeah. And who was the suicide rate most? Men.
Men.
And that is why does society tell us to do that? This is one thing from, I'm talking from 2007 till maybe 5 years ago now, that there was no men. Well, I couldn't even look to, maybe sober coaches, just say for argument's sake, friends that I do have or I've met, who I can half take a bit of their story, because I've come out with the addiction of Tamazi and diazepam for years, where my mental's off the Richter scale. So I've suffered pharmaceutical addiction. That was all I had. A male coach talking online just so I could reach out. Where was the mental health? Like you said, us today, there weren't even that. Only up to about 5 years ago, as men started coming out. And I don't know what your experience was like. When I first come out, Jesus Christ, I was like, I might as well have been a woman. So men in my life,
for me, I had such a positive. You had the odd person go, look at this big crybaby.
Yeah.
Keyboard warriors sitting in a house. You know what I mean? Like probably 7 years old, giving it the big one on the computer. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But I was so scared, mate. I was probably the first time in my life I was scared about how people would view me as a person, because I'm a geezer, I'm a man, I'm a lad, you know. But it was the first time I was absolutely scared, and you know, it took me a minute to send my coming out with my feelings and my thoughts and being weak is what society would label that as, to even send that to a friend that's with me on a daily basis every day. He had to view it to be able to edit it and put it out, which I weren't much editing. It was just a case of, you know, adverts and logos and what have you, but because I liked to kept it raw.
Yeah.
But
don't you see it as being free though, rather than weak now?
This is what I'm saying, yeah? The power from being weak gave me so much strength,
yeah,
that it allowed me to see the coward in a lot of people for not coming forward and just being able to speak, you know? And hopefully, and it is working, that a lot of other people, they get that from this and they carry on doing what we're doing today further on when we hang up our gloves. Yeah. They then put them on and they carry on for us to be able to keep that legacy, because we haven't got many role models now. All our role models are going to jail, and you know, even our kids that are looking up to the next generation are actually younger than us, and they're doing adult things that we should be looking up to, and we're not really because they're all in jail, so doing life sentences and stuff. Exactly. Like, so what have we got? I mean, we now have to produce a future for the ones before that to be able to make it past 16, to not be dead, to not be serving a life sentence, and to be on like a successful career pattern and see the real in life rather than just this false sense of, yeah, I've got to be a geezer, you mess with me, I've got to go from the hip up and make sure that you're dead. You know, it's absolutely crazy. You know, this podcast for me went exactly how I thought it was going to go with me and you, because we've linked over the phones and stuff, and we've spoke many, like a few times, and on how it was, and you know, and the fact that we got to do this today is absolutely amazing. And I'm glad that it's a little bit different to what you normally do, because we were like, you know, talking old times and this stuff. But you know, I think today you sharing your story with us, and I know you're saying it's for the last time, I really appreciate you doing this for the channel and for other people to be able to get this out there.
Well, I appreciate you having me as always, Paul. You know, like, it's just, it's nice to just come and talk with you, really. Do you know what I mean? It's not about and share a message, but I just want to say one thing. When you talk about strengths at the end, when you say my biggest strength, that is from everything that I did do with the charity work and everything else. And it'll do the same to you. It makes you so strong in the end that we're talking about free. You're so strong and so free in the end that you walk around untouchable in your own mind, because I can walk through any walk of life now, have a laugh, a joke. Nothing really bothers me anymore. So this is the level that all of my work maybe got me to, my pinnacle. So, and I guess that's something for you to look forward to from someone that's sort of done it before you.
Yeah.
That's when you know your pinnacle is when you're so happy and so strong in yourself now that you can walk around and help anyone. That's your pinnacle, man.
I appreciate that, man. I appreciate that. I appreciate that, and I respect you 100%. And you have a friend for life with me.
And same as brother. Yeah,
I appreciate
you. I wouldn't want it any other way.
I'm right. Thank you so much, brother. I appreciate you. Cheers.